Okay, this is Wednesday, January 22nd, 1975, on Western Airlines Flight 580, en route from Honolulu to San Francisco. Seat 15G, we just turned in our cards for the halfway game. And I, yesterday, finally got in touch with two of the men who were on Baker Island in 1941, when they came under attack from Japanese forces and were later evacuated. And I'm trying to put down on tape here before I forget it what the two men told me. The first man I was able to contact was Mr. Blue, B-L-U-E, Makua, M-A-K-U-A. Blue went down on cruise number 22 to Baker Island. And he was on Baker Island along with Walter Burke, W-A-L-T-E-R-B-U-R-K-E. And Walter Burke was the leader on Baker Island. And the other two men were Mr. Coyle, C-O-Y-L-E, and Mr. Pease, P-E-A-S-E. As the conversation with Mr. Makua went like this. It was on the telephone, and he lives in Kailua, and his address in Kailua is 39 South Kalaheo, K-A-L-A-H-E-O Drive, Kailua. His phone number is 261-0329. And Blue said that he didn't remember too much about what had happened, except that he went down on the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Taney in July of 1941, or he maybe went down earlier than that. But when the two men came along, Mr. Coyle and Mr. Pease, who replaced him, they also came down on the Taney. But they were picked up on January 31st, to the best of his recollection, 1942, by a Navy destroyer. He doesn't remember the name of the destroyer, but he believes that it later got sunk in the Coral Sea. But it was a U.S. Navy destroyer, and it wasn't an old four-stacker. He believed it was a one- or two-stacker. It was a first-class destroyer, a big one, because he remembers that it had torpedoes mounted on its deck. But he doesn't know too much, doesn't really know much about anything that happened on Howland Island on December 18, 1941. But what he remembers about on Baker Island is that he was asleep in the government house, and the leader, Walter Burke, came down into the government house and says there's a submarine right off the shore. And it was before sunrise. It was just about dawn. And Walter Burke had gotten up to take his early morning observation. And it just in the first light of day, he saw this submarine offshore. And he knew it was a Japanese submarine. And so he went down, because they'd heard from Howland Island the day before that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And so he came down and woke the guys up and told them that there was a Jap submarine. They better get out of the building and go hide, because there'd probably be a landing party come ashore. And so they decided, in order to keep the submarine from seeing them, that they should go out a back window, because the sub was on the west side of the island. If they went out the back window, the sub wouldn't be able to see them getting out of the building. And just as they started to go out, one of the shells hit the building and blew the roof off of it. But luckily, none of the four men were hurt. And they went out and they hid out on the west side so the submarine couldn't find them. He said they took some corrugated tin and kind of made dugouts down in the coral. In fact, at high tide, the dugouts used to get water in them. He remembers that they had this corrugated tin over the top of them, and they were careful so nobody could would see them, because an airplane came over every day. But the sub blew up the buildings and everything with its cannon, but it didn't machine gun or anything that he remembers. But later there was an airplane that came over and bombed them. And also they strafed him. In fact, one time he was running along with another guy, and he remembers it was a big machine gun. It must have been a 20 millimeter machine gun was firing at him, and one of the bullets almost hit him in the back, and he nearly got shot, but he was lucky and the bullets just missed him. But they hit out, and the airplane used to come over every day, and he said that he remembers they knew the airplane was coming because the booby birds, or the frigate birds, that is, the frigate birds, would start flying around. And whenever the frigate birds started to get edgy, evidently they could feel or hear the airplane coming before they could. And then they would, as soon as they saw the frigate birds starting to act up, they would go and hide, so the airplane couldn't see them. And the airplane never dropped any more bombs or strafed them, because they were stayed hidden so nobody could find them. And he remembers when the destroyer came that they had a dugout canoe, and they went out over the surf in the dugout canoe to the destroyer, and they does remember that when the two guys came down later in the year to replace the two guys that went back, that it was a Taney, the United States Coast Guard cutter Taney, that brought him down, but he does not remember the name of the destroyer that picked him up. That's about all that he remembered, except he told me to call Walter Burke. Walter Burke was the leader on Baker Island, and he said that Mr. Burke would be able to help me. So I did call Walter Burke. That's at 99-058 Manalua Road. That's Manalua Road, Aiea, A-I-E-A. His phone number is 488-576. And his memory was very good, and he gave me quite a story. Mr. Burke came down on the Taney, also T-A-N-E-Y, and he remembers that Peace and Coyle came down on the Taney. They saw some ship's light, just some lights of a ship, about September 1941. They never did know what ship it was, but they just saw the lights of the ship during the night, and it went by. When they were contacted Howland at their schedule to give them the weather reports, what they did is they used to transmit their weather reports to Howland, and then Howland would transmit them on to Jarvis and to Honolulu. And when they kept their schedule, they were told by Howland that Pearl Harbor had been attacked by the Japanese, and to keep silent and don't say anything on the radio, but listen during the schedules with the receiver, but don't use the transmitter at all. In fact, he said that Joseph Kali'i Hananui, who was later killed on Howland, got on the radio and talked in Hawaiian. They talked using the Hawaiian language so that the Japanese couldn't understand them. And he used it kind of like a code. And Kali'i Hananui told him to don't transmit at all, that they would tell them if anything different happened, if they got any word from Honolulu, and maybe radio silent, just listen on their scheduled times. And they did it all in the Hawaiian language. About next day, December 8th, he woke up in the morning. They had the water tank up on a tower, and he had his bunk up there, and Walter Burke slept up there. He slept by himself up high, keep away from the rats, and also a nice breeze. So he used to sleep on the water tower. He had his bunk up there. and he woke up in the morning just before daylight, just at the first light of day, and when he looked out towards the reef, he saw there was a submarine just sitting just off the reef. And so he knew it was a Japanese submarine, or rather he was pretty sure it was, so he decided he better go down and wake up the other guys. So he went down into the government house, and he was waking them up, and he said, "We better get out of here. There's a Japanese submarine just off the reef." And so they just started to get out of the government house when the Japanese fired their cannon on the deck of the submarine, and the first shell hit the roof right up along the roof line, and it blew the whole roof right off the top of the shed. But boy, they scooted out of there in a hurry. They ran out the back window and kept the building between them and the sub, and they went over to the east side of the island and hid out. And altogether, the sub fired about 12 shots towards them. And they blew up the water tower where he had his bunk, and blew up the water tank. It sunk. They blew up the storeroom, and they destroyed the government house completely. It only took about 12 shots, and the camp was a complete ruins. So they hid out on the other side of the island, though it's only a half a mile or three quarters of a mile away. And pretty soon the sub went out a little further offshore, and it submerged. But they could see its periscope every once in a while up off the western side of the island, and all day long they could see it. But most of the time, every once in a while they could see the periscope. But just after sundown and before dusk, the sub surfaced again. And they were afraid that the Japanese was going to put ashore a landing party. So they started to shoot at them with a cannon again, and this time they must have saw them. They saw shot at them with cannon and a machine gun. They shot directly at them. They must have seen them through binoculars or something. They fired at them with a machine gun, but the sand absorbed all of the shots, and instead of any ricocheting bullets or any fragmentations from the shells or anything, why, the shells just hit the sand and were absorbed. But everything was ruined on the island by the shelling that had already taken place. The radio was completely knocked out. They couldn't receive or couldn't transmit. And finally the sub went off and submerged, and they never saw anything of it again. Once they were sure the sub was gone, why, they knew that it was very bad to have all their water in one place. So there were still several barrels of water that hadn't been destroyed. So they took the barrels out and spread them out around the island and hid them and put them down in low spots and tried to hide them. And so they wouldn't have all the water in one place, because if the water was without water, they wouldn't last very long. So they took the barrels of water that weren't ruined and put them out and around different places on the island so that they wouldn't all be in one place. The following day, about the December 9th, maybe it was the 10th, they heard a plane coming, and it was a four-engine seaplane, and it came, and they hid out, and they stayed away from the government area, and the plane made a bombing run on them, and it dropped a string of six bombs on the first run, and then it came back, and it made another run, and it dropped six more bombs, but the bombs really didn't do anything. Everything had been ruined by the sub shells anyway, but Blue and Peace kind of lost their heads when the bombs started falling, and they started running. And when they started running, the seaplane saw them running, and they had a heavy machine gun in the seaplane and started firing at them. And they were very lucky they didn't get killed. Finally, they ran out into the surf, and Blue and Peace lay down in the surf with the white water breaking over them, and the airplane must have couldn't see them, or else they thought they'd shot them, because they finally quit shooting at them, and the plane went away. but they had moved the remaining water drums from the shed to across the island, spread them out, and there wasn't really any damage done by the airplane, though they were very lucky that Blue and Peace didn't get machine gunned. Well, that airplane came back nearly every day, and it didn't come back at exactly the same time every day, but usually around noontime, sometime a little before noon, sometimes a little afternoon, but sometime around noon it came back, and they'd hear it coming, we'd hear it coming, and they'd run and hide. And if it was high tide, he said, the hole they had dug actually it has some water in it, but they had this corrugated tin and covering over them, and the Japs never did shell them or bomb them or strafe them again. And then about a month and a half, and it was around, maybe January 26th or somewhere around that area, maybe 28th, there was a U.S. Navy PBY came flying over. But they saw the airplane, and they knew it was a U.S. Navy PBY, but they were so scared they wouldn't come out. They just they weren't going to take any chances. That other airplane, four-engine seaplane, had wrecked so much havoc that they were scared to come out, and so they stayed hidden. And three days later, a destroyer came, and they saw the destroyer coming. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and they saw the American flag on the destroyer, but they were still so scared they stayed hidden. They wouldn't take any chances. Well, then the destroyer stopped, and it put a whaleboat over the side, and they saw a landing party was coming ashore. But the surf was so heavy that that the landing party couldn't get ashore. Well, they saw the guys in the boats. One of them had red hair, so they knew they were Howley boys, or they knew they were American. They weren't Japanese. And so they finally came out and showed themselves. And the surf was really starting to build up bad by then. Well, it happened that Coyle couldn't swim. Well, they had a dugout canoe they had made. They took the dugout canoe, and Blue took Coyle, who couldn't swim, put him in the dugout canoe, and took him out through the surf. And he took him out to the motor whaleboat, transferred him to the motor whaleboat. Then Blue took the dugout back through the surf again and picked up Pease. And then when he was taking Pease out through the surf, the canoe got swamped. The surf got so heavy that they couldn't make it through, but they continued to swim even though they were in the water and sharks were all around. They continued to swim until they got to the motor whaleboat. And the motor whaleboat picked them up and picked Blue and Peace both up. So Blue motioned for Walter Burke to go down to the south end of the island where the surf wasn't so bad, and Blue told the lieutenant that was on the whaleboat to go down to the south end of the island, and they would be able to pick up Walter Burke down there. So they went down the south side beach, but the motor whaleboat couldn't come in, so Blue picked up a life jacket and tied a rope around himself, and he held the life jacket up so that and held the rope end of the rope up so that Walter Burke would see what he was doing, and then he jumped in the water. It was filled with sharks and everything, but he jumped in the water and he started to swim with a rope around his waist and with a life jacket on and with the other life jacket in his hand into the beach to pick up Burke. And Burke jumped in the water and started to swim out through the surf, and they met right in the middle of the surf. And Blue gave the jacket to Burke, and he put it on, and then the guys in the whaleboat pulled on the rope, and they pulled them both over to the whaleboat and pulled them on. Well, they went over to the destroyer, and he believes that it was the USS Helm, H-E-L-M. He's not sure of that, but he thinks it was the USS Helm that picked them up. When he got on, they found that Matson and Betterman had already been picked up on Howland Island. And Betterman asking, why did you hide from the destroyer? Why didn't you show yourself when we came over? And he said, well, we were scared. And until we saw the red-headed guy in the whaleboat, we were afraid to come out. But we were just too afraid that it might be a Japanese destroyer instead of an American one. And even though they saw the flag, they thought it might be a trick. Well, he said, well, you're lucky we came because there was a PBY flew over your island, and they said you were all dead because they saw no trace of you at all, and they said you weren't there. And when you saw the PBY, why didn't you signal to him? And we told him we were scared. And he said, well, he could understand that because when the PBY came over them the same day, they didn't come out either. They were so afraid that it was a Japanese airplane instead of a Navy PBY, a U.S. airplane, that they didn't come out either. But luckily, the PBY saw some blankets and mattress covers that the guys had been using to sleep on away from the island. So they sent the destroyer just in case somebody was alive. But they saw no indication that anybody was alive at Baker Island, so they almost didn't come to Baker. They thought, well, as long as we're here, we'll come and make sure that there's nobody still alive there. So we were just lucky that they came down to Baker to pick us up. But it turned out that Betterman and Mattson was just as afraid as we were, and they didn't come out and wave to the PBY either. Well, after I saw Betterman, according to Burke, the executive officer of the ship wanted to interview him and interrogate him about what happened. So he went up onto the executive officer's quarters, and he was answering the questions that the executive officer had for him. He doesn't remember his name. And he said, were you bombed or anything? And he said, yes, we were bombed a day or two after the sub was there. And an airplane came over every day. And he said, oh, about what time? And I said, oh, about this time, usually a little before or a little after noon. And he said, the funniest look came over the executive officer's face. He said, you mean that a Japanese airplane comes here every day at this time? And yeah, just about this time. And he ran out and he sounded general quarters on the ship, and they closed all the watertight doors and everything, and we were trapped in the compartment we were at. And sure enough, within 15 minutes, the Japanese airplane came, just like it always did, and tried to bomb the ship, but it missed the ship, and the ship fired back at it, but the bombs didn't do much damage, and they really don't know about how effective their anti-aircraft fire was. But the funniest thing was the executive officer was so surprised when I told him that a Japanese airplane came every day about this time, and he realized that, by God, they were hit there and that the plane would be there shortly. Well, anyway, the destroyer proceeded to a rendezvous somewhere near Canton Island. Mr. Burke didn't know exactly where it was, but he believed it was a Haleakala. It was a supply ship that had been at Howland at Canton Island, and they picked up the Haleakala and escorted it to Honolulu. And he believed they arrived in Honolulu about February 5th or 6th or something like that. He's not exactly sure when they got back. They docked in maybe the 8th or 9th. But they went, picked up the Haleakala and convoyed it to Honolulu. They met the Haleakala at sea. But later, in 1943, the Navy decided to reoccupy Baker Island, and the Army Air Corps wanted to build a strip there for the invasion of Tarawa and make an island. And they asked Blue Makua if he would help them and return to Baker Island, and Blue said no, he wanted no part of it. And Mr. Burke worked for the police department in Honolulu then, and they called him and asked him if he would go to Baker. And he did. He went down to Baker Island and helped them in their building the airstrip down there. And he remembers that they used steel mats for the runway. And when they left, they just left everything, steel mats and all, to the best of his recollection. That was in, he thought, August or September 1943. Later, when talking to Mrs. Kenner, I found out that Admiral Kenner, in 1943, went down and helped the men get through the surf and helped them get into Baker Island, was in on that operation. I tried to find Mr. Betterman, or Alvin K. Matson, M-A-T-T-S-O-N, who were on Howland Island, but was unable to do so. The last anyone heard of Mr. Betterman was about 1970-71, when one of the men, I believe it was Oliver Roberts, said he got a Christmas card from Tom Betterman about 1971 from South America. He believed it was from Santo Tomas or something like that on the Atlantic coast of South America, but that was about all he knew. Mr. Matson, now it's listed in the book as Alvin, A-L-V-I-N-K Matson, but no one seemed to remember much about him, except that they thought maybe he lived up in Kalihi somewhere, and he hurt his back while working for the Navy shipyard. Everybody seems to be vague. They thought he had a cousin who worked for the City and County Corporation Council, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, in it's a Department of Corporation Council, investigator for the Corporation Council, Mr. Fred Matson, M-A-T-T-S-O-N, the City and County of Honolulu. His phone number was 546-2725. I called Fred Matson, and he said yes, but he didn't think that the Matson who was a relative of his was on Howland Island. I asked him if it was Alvin or Elvin, and he said, he thought it was, he didn't really know which it was. However, he said that when I was on ship, I talked to Tom Betterman, according to Mr. Burke, the best he could remember about what happened on Howland was that they went fishing the morning of the 8th, and about midday they heard the drone of a lot of airplanes. They thought maybe there was about 14 airplanes altogether, and there was a whole bunch of them. Well, Tom said he thought about three of them came over and they raked Howland Islands with bombs and machine guns. He wasn't sure. He doesn't remember exactly what kind. He thought maybe they were twin-engine airplanes. But Betterman seemed to think that there was about a whole flight of them, about 14 of them, but only about three of them came over to Howland itself and raked them with bombs and machine gun fire. Now, the two men that were killed, they went running from the government house, and those two went running in one direction, and Betterman and Matson went running in the other direction, and a bomb dropped right close to where Ka'i Nuni, right near where Joseph Kali'i Hananui, K-E-L-I-I-H-A-N-A-N-U-I, Kali'i Hananui, and Richard Waverly, W-H-A-L-E-Y. A bomb dropped real close to them, and it killed Richard Whaley outright. But according to Burke, when Betterman told him, Kali'i Hananui had one leg blown off and other injuries, but he didn't die right away. He died a little bit later, maybe a few hours later, but Richard Whaley was killed instantly. And that happened according to the records of December 18, 1941, but the recollection that Burke had of Betterman told him, he thought it was about the 8th, but I don't know. I'd have to go in the Navy records to find that out. But anyway, they the other two men, Betterman and Mattson, weren't hurt at all. They, but it did destroy everything around the government house and everything. So they did the same thing that the men did on Baker. They had no radio. They couldn't receive anything. They couldn't transmit. They didn't know what was going on. But they took enough of their food and water and whatnot, and they hid out. And they were never attacked again. But when the PBY came over, they wouldn't come out and waved to the PBY either. They were too scared, even on Howland. So the only thing that the PBY saw, I mentioned before, was the mattress covers and the blankets that the guys had used when sleeping out. And the PBY had seen those and thought, well, there must be somebody around there somewhere. So they decided to send the destroyer to Howland Island. But they didn't see any sign of life on Baker. So the destroyer came to Baker Island just on speculation. But that was about all he knew about what happened on Howland Island, except the two men that were killed were left there. And it wasn't until possibly as late as 1953, though I don't hardly see how it could be that late, before the men were picked up, the bodies were picked up. But at least now, they're buried at Schofield Barracks, and their graves are at Schofield Barracks. And Mrs. Kenner thought that Admiral Kenner attended their funeral in 1953. But it seems to me like when they went back into Baker, maybe they picked the island up off Howland in 1943. Of course, the sidelight to all this is that in July 1943, though I had no idea that a month or two later they were going to come in and reoccupy Howland and Baker, I was flying PBYs out of Canton, and we used to fly out to Howland and Baker. We had a flight every day that went out there, and the Japanese had a flight that flew out there every day, and lots of times we used to see them or meet them. At that time, though, they were four-engine seaplanes, but they were what we called Emily's, and they were a much higher performance airplane than the PBY. The old Mavis really wasn't that high a performance. In my telephone conversation just before I left for the mainland today, I contacted Fred Mattson at the Corporation Council for the City and County of Honolulu, and I asked him if Alvin K. Mattingly, I'm sorry, Mattson, was a relative of his, and he said yes. But I asked him, when I asked him if he was the one that was at Howland Island, he said he didn't think so. He was on the Line Islands, but he was not on Howland Island. And I asked him, well, was it Alvin K. or Elvin? And he didn't really seem to know. I don't quite understand. But anyway, he said that the E.K. Mattson in the phone book was the one, and he gave me the number. And I don't know, maybe we can run it down. But I talked to Mr. Roberts, I believe, at the time, and he didn't think that Mattson was on Howland Island in 1941 and 42. But I am only going by the Panalaau memoirs, which said that Betterman and Mattson were on there. And while Burke remembered talking to Betterman, he didn't mention talking to Mattson, so I don't know. We'll have to dig into that a little deeper. But if it was the USS Helm, why, if we can get back to the logs, if they weren't lost, why, we should be able to pick something up. I didn't get a chance to check the Honolulu newspapers to see if there was anything on it. That would have been about February 8th, 9th, 10th, somewhere around in there, if they had any report when they came back in from Howland and Baker on the destroyer into Honolulu. That's about it. Now, just for a few sidelights, when we were talking to Mrs. Kenner today, she said a couple, three things that I found really interesting. One, that her husband smoked four or five packs of Chesterfields every day. She kept telling me I ought to switch to Camels. She smoked Camels. And she woke up one morning, and about 4:30 in the morning, her husband had woke up, and he was sitting on the side of the bed, and he just collapsed and died. And another thing was that he liked to dance. And she said that he couldn't understand for a long time why the Hawaiian boys were eating so much rice. They finally figured it out, found out they were making rice wine, and they were using the rice to make the sake or rice wine. And an inordinate amount of rice was being poured into the islands, supposedly for them to eat. But there was a little winemaking going on the side, I think. She was very, very nice to allow me to take her album and shoot some of the pictures out of it. And we'll study those out and should be able to put quite a few things together from that.